So we're going to talk about a subject matter that perhaps is not direct Krishna consciousness today, but it relates to Krishna consciousness because in Krishna consciousness, we do believe that there is a creator, a controller, and a designer, don't we? Does everyone agree with that? The opposite of that is something where it's called atheism, where you don't believe that there is a controller, a designer, or anything like that. And everything happened by chance. So this is first part of a multi-part presentation. We're just doing one part today. It's going to be quite easy, and anyone over 12 years old, I think, will be able to understand this. So if you're under 12, well, maybe not. And if you have any questions at the end, we'll answer the questions. So this first part is called Irreducible Complexity, and of course, we're doing this by the mercy of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who is the founder Acharya of our International Society for Krishna Consciousness, and who has convinced many of us, including me, that life comes from life. Because my background, before I came in contact with Prabhupada, I was a scientist, or maybe not an atheist scientist, but pretty close. And Prabhupada gave us, many of us, the mission to establish this principle that life comes from life. And Prabhupada established an institute called the Bhaktivedanta Institute specifically for that purpose, and Prabhupada himself allocated a lot of funds specifically. That funds means money specifically for that purpose. So there's basically four arguments that I'm using. I'm only going to use one of the arguments today to establish that this material world was designed, or specifically that life was designed. And the one we're going to use today is called irreducible complexity. And that basically means that everything is so complex it must be designed. And I'll go through this whole presentation explaining that. The other arguments in favor of a designer are forces of nature. There's many subatomic forces, and like gravitation, and what's called the weak and the strong, and electromagnetism, which I'm not going to get into today, that actually show that they were finely tuned for life and for the universe. Another one is called information in life, because in the DNA, there is so much information, it's compared sometimes to a computer program that must be designed by a person. And the fourth argument for life comes from life is called the chicken and egg argument. That basically, I'll give you a summary of that argument. That argument is that people who are the evolutionists who say that life came from matter, they say that matter evolved into life. Well, nothing can evolve into life unless there is something called DNA in it. DNA is the code for life. Otherwise, there's no question of what they call survival of the fittest. Don't worry about these other arguments. Let's go on to today. So this is the verse from the Bhagavad Gita. Satyam apratishtam te jagadaru anichvaram aparaspara sambhutam kimanyat kama haitukam. And the translation is up there. People say, this is actually from the chapter called The Divine and Demoniac Natures in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 16, verse 8. They say that this world is unreal with no foundation, no God in control. They say it is produced of sex desire and has no cause other than lust. In other words, what Prabhupada is addressing, what Krishna is addressing here, is the theory of evolution where, based upon reproduction, which is lust here, so to speak, sorry about that word, based upon reproduction and natural selection, that particular species evolved, or even life came into being in the beginning. So, of course, as members of the Krishna Conscious Movement, some of you are members and some of you are not, our particular epistemology, that means, epistemology means how we understand what we understand, is coming from what we call the descending process. In other words, when you actually accept the authority of the Vedic literatures, which come from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then you accept that as absolute and true. But the problem is that most people, problem, whether it's a problem, whether it's a good thing, but most people don't accept that. So we have to present things in terms of logic, reason, and science, which is my training. So this is a scientific presentation showing that God is there. There's a designer of everything. So, but I don't need this type of presentation to believe it. Why don't I need this presentation to believe it? Because I've been chanting Hare Krishna for God knows how many years. You know, 48 years. 48 years, 16 rounds every day without fail. And then after doing this particular activity and serving Krishna, there's realizations, things that come to one's understanding automatically. That's described by Krishna in the 9th chapter of the Gita. Prachaksha bhagamam dharmyam, shushukam kartamavyam. That one begins to see things directly, understand things directly by practicing Krishna consciousness. When one chants the holy name, it's like the sun coming up in the morning, that you gradually see everything. Before the sun comes up, it's simply darkness. And when the sun first starts coming up, you actually see some shadows and black and white things. But later on, you actually see colors and the whole reality of the world. So, this is for those of you who may not be completely convinced of the Veda conclusion. So, there are two options when we look at the creation of this material world, or the beginning of this material world and the beginning of life. One option you see on the left here is that it was designed. And the option you see on the right is what we call a die, or one dice. You know, that's die, singular. That it's simply by chance. You know, not someone rolled the dice, but the dice happened to roll by themselves, somehow or other. And came up. Anyone here ever played dice? Snake eyes? You ever heard of that before? Anyway, that means two ones. And somehow or other, life came about. So, of those two options, the one commonly believed in by scientists today, and the one they have to believe in, is something called Neo-Darwinism. Now, you don't have to memorize all these different terms here, but Darwinism is basically the philosophy that everything came about by chance and natural selection. Natural selection means that, let us say, there was a mutation. So, let's say there was a rabbit. Let's take a rabbit. He was had a mutation, and somehow or other, the rabbit developed wings. Somehow or other, which is impossible. And then that was more favorable for his survivability because he could fly away from his prey. But no one here has seen a rabbit with wings. So that's just a funny example of what natural selection is. Mutation means a change in the genetic structure, and because of that, the rabbit developed wings, which is actually impossible. So that's basically the Darwinian theory and the Neo-Darwin theory. So, this means by undirected natural forces of mutation and natural selection by what or how the living entity survived more because of the changes in his design, the different species evolved. There's a problem with that. This is one problem here. This is an example of one mutation. It's a tortoise with two heads. The problem with mutations is that usually when there's a mutation, then that particular entity can't reproduce. That's called sterility. And also the problem with it is that the living entity will die, usually from the mutation. They're usually not productive. And what to speak of one species becoming another species due to the difference, and primarily the difference in what we call the chromosomes. Chromosomes are part of the genes in the cell. Between one species and another, you don't really have the possibility of one species becoming another. For example, let's say that rabbit we were talking about before developed wings. Well, maybe he would develop wings. Of course he wouldn't. But if he developed wings, I don't think he would meet a female rabbit who would want to reproduce with him. Nor would it work, because he'd be genetically different. You understand? Because between different species, you can't have reproduction. You definitely don't, between different species. So, I mean, just like people can't have children with monkeys. Even though they may look the same, act the same, and think the same, you know, there's no possibility. So even if there was a mutation that caused someone to have some really amazing new characteristics, like a man with two heads or something like that, he probably wouldn't find a wife. And even and secondly, he probably wouldn't find a job either to support his wife. Thirdly, they wouldn't be able to have any children. So the mutation thing really doesn't work. So let's talk about what science is. Let's define science. And people have different definitions of science. This is from the Standard Dictionary, which is known as the Webster's Dictionary. It means the state of knowing knowledge as distinguished from ignorance or misunderstanding. That's the first definition given in what's called the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. And science has two basic ways of understanding things. One way is by what we call the scientific method, which is an experiment. You take two parts of hydrogen, one part of oxygen, you mix them together, and what do you get? Water. So you do it a few times, and you think, yeah, this is true. Water is two parts hydrogen, one part oxygen. Fine, that's an experiment. Another way of understanding matter scientists use is called observation. And by observing things, they come up with certain conclusions, even though they don't have control over the things that they're observing. For example, someone, scientists will look through a telescope and he'll see different astronomical phenomena. That means things happening in the stars. And he'll come up with a conclusion. Like he'll say, oh, nowadays they talk about dark matter or dark energy or the Big Bang theory. And of course, they haven't seen the Big Bang. I don't think so. We also, actually, it's interesting, we also believe in the Big Bang theory because once upon a time, Mahavishnu, this may be astounding to you, but Mahavishnu, an incarnation of God, was lying down and the universes came out of his body, the pores of his body, and they expanded, and that was the Big Bang. So, but it wasn't that we believe in something from nothing, like many scientists may believe. So these are the two methods of scientific understanding. So we'd like to examine how life began. So here's a time machine, which we don't have. So we can't really utilize that method, you know, go back to the future, or whatever, back to the past, and try to see what happened in the past. We have to observe what is happening now and look at certain evidence that we see from the past and try to come up with a reasonable conclusion. And so in coming up with a reasonable conclusion, we may think that there are several different causes for that thing to have occurred. We examine the different, what's called multiple competing hypotheses, which means causes. Hypotheses, of course, doesn't mean cause, it means guess. That's a fancy scientific word for guess, in case you haven't figured that out. That I have a hypothesis. Instead, why don't they just say, I'm guessing? So there's a historical event, and we sort of guess at what caused it. And then The scientists use something to come up with what they consider to be the best explanation. It's called inference as to the best explanation. And this is based on examining things that you see today and understanding how cause and effect functions today and extrapolating that or projecting that into the past. Does everybody understand that? Okay. And so there's different competing types of causes of any particular thing that one may observe. So you come up with the best explanation. That's a scientific method. It's called guessing, but it's based on what we call an educated guess. So here's the scientific method in this regard. Here are the facts. What conclusion can we draw from them? That's scientific. It's impartial, unbiased. So even our friend Darwin, some of you may have heard of him, he was the one who wrote Origin of the Species. He went to this interesting place called the Galapagos Islands. Anyone's heard of the place before? Galapagos Islands. And he saw all these different creatures that were different from any other creatures he had ever seen and came up with his conclusion that life evolved by chance. But he even made the point in this quote from his book, it seems to me that supposing that such a guess, I'm translating hypothesis into guess, were to explain such general propositions, we ought, in accordance with a common way of following all sciences, to admit it until some better guess be found out. Okay? Try and remember that. So, in other words, the scientists, when they look at something that they can't directly touch or control, have to make guesses. They can't say, it's absolutely sure, this is our best guess. But the problem is, oh, here's another point. This is spoken by an Englishman. The principles of geology being an attempt to explain the former changes of the Earth's surface by references to causes now in operation. So we use the cause and effect that we see in this world to understand things that happened in the past, cause and effect that we see now in this world. Unfortunately, the scientists ascribe, many scientists ascribe to something called methodological naturalism, which means, basically, they assume that there's no creator when they start looking at everything. In other words, it's methodological, what we would call atheism in philosophy or in the study of religion. In fact, in the universities, when people study religion, they study religion based upon methodological atheism, just examining it externally. They assume that God doesn't exist to study religion. Very intelligent, isn't it? Like Prabhupada said, it's like licking on the outside of a bottle of honey. You cannot taste the honey. You cannot understand. For example, you come to the Hare Krishna temple and you see everybody dancing and chanting. And you don't dance and chant, you're a scientist, you're just analyzing everything with the idea that actually there's no God. So then you just say, well, these people are just exercising. And sometimes they do push-ups. They call it an obeisance. So you that's methodological atheism, that they would just like analyze everything based upon just external symptoms. Oh, yes, their adrenaline is increasing, and, you know, they'd go into all the bodily symptoms and think or say it's all material. So that's the problem with atheistic scientists, that they assume before they examine life, they assume that it just happened by that there's no God. They only accept what we call empirical causes, causes that are there in this world. But there's a lot more than causes that we see with our eyes or can perceive with our instruments. So here's an example of a scientist here, or a detective in this particular picture. The detective is investigating this man who just died. And he's trying to figure out who killed the guy. You know, he has his little device here, he's looking and seeing who killed this guy, and he doesn't see the elephant in the same room. So this is like many scientists. And of course, in science, In many branches of science, if you actually even come up with the idea that maybe God created things or there's a creator, you will be kicked out of your job at the university or wherever you are. There's actually an interesting movie that was made about this. It was called Intelligence. No intelligence allowed. Expelled, no intelligence allowed. You can look it up on YouTube if you like later on. And it showed how professors who put forth the philosophy that life came from someone designing life, they lose their standing in the academic field. So you can't even have that opinion. So here's another famous atheist. Maybe some of you have heard of him. His name is Richard Dawkins. Anyone's heard of him? No. Perhaps the most famous atheist nowadays. And his statement is, here's his bias. Bias means that he is assuming something before he investigates it. So he states that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of design, the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. So if something appears to have been designed, why couldn't it have been designed? So he defines biology like that because basically he probably had some trouble with his father. And he's projecting that upon God, who is the Supreme Father. I mean, there's always a psychological reason for that. And here's the one of the discoverers of the form of DNA. His name is Francis Crick. And he stated something very similar to this. He said, biologists must constantly keep in mind that which they see was not designed, but rather evolved. In other words, they have to constantly remind themselves, it looks like it was designed. No, it didn't. It's not designed. He says, constantly keep in mind. That means you, practically every day you're going to have doubts. And you just have to keep reminding you, the other scientists will say, you know, don't have doubts. It's like a devotee who's enjoying the Hare Krishna movement, he may have some doubts about the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, and the other brahmacharis just saying, you know, don't have any doubts, chant Hare Krishna, eat some prasadam, it'll go away the next morning. So even Francis Crick, the famous scientist. So we're going to talk about irreducible complexity. And irreducible complexity means that there is a system composed of many different interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, and if you take any of those parts away, that function will not, you won't have that function. The machine or whatever it is won't function. Here's a typical example, a very simple example of this. It's called does anyone know what it is? A mousetrap. Okay, so if you take away the bar or the platform or the spring or the hammer, you're not going to have a mousetrap. You may have a paperweight. You may have, I don't know what else you have, a design, a nice design, but you won't have a mousetrap. It's irreducibly complex, but it's not very complex. And, of course, there's a lot of machines that are even more complex, like this is a 787 or something. I think it's a 7. Yeah, it's 787 jet. It has millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of interacting parts. And obviously, does anyone here think it was not designed? I mean, anybody think that? Okay. And here's an interesting design. I don't know if you can understand this. This is made by a funny cartoonist named Rube Goldberg. And I'll read this because you probably can't read it from there. This is a method by which a man uses to scratch his back without having to use his hand to scratch his back because he doesn't want to interfere with his relationship with this beautiful lady that he's talking to. So it's the water falls from a drain pipe, drops into a container or flask, then there's a cork which rises with the water, carries the needle with it, punctures something else, contain And that contains beer. Beer sprinkles all over a bird, and the bird becomes intoxicated and falls on a spring, which bounces him. And he thinks the spring is a worm. The string flies off, a cannon, which frightens. Anyway, you get the idea. It's pretty complicated. It's a funny, complicated thing. If you take away any of those elements, the guy's back won't be scratched. Here's another quote from Charles Darwin. He said, if it can be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, Darwin admits, my theory would break down, but I can find out no such case. So Darwin couldn't find out the case because he didn't know better. They didn't have modern scientific instruments. In fact, if one is very ignorant or young and doesn't know too much about what's happening with the material nature, they can get bewildered and think, even like a child may think, as Prabhupada thought, that there were people inside a radio. I mean, I also thought that there was a man and some men inside televisions when I first saw a television when I was a kid. Many children think like that. I thought if I smashed the television, I could go into another world and see all these nice people who were dancing for me. But it's not like that, because that's not the way it is. The television is a very complicated thing, and there's no people inside the television, or cars function in a certain way. You know, it's when people are very simple-minded, don't have enough knowledge, they may come to different conclusions like children do. Now, the reason that... So Darwin came to... I'll explain the reason why Darwin came to this particular conclusion, and scientists originally did. First of all, they thought that the cell... They couldn't see inside the cell, and I'll explain why. Because their microscopes were not sufficiently powerful. So they thought the cell in our body was just a lump of, let's say, protoplasm. Here's a quote from a famous biologist. The cell is not composed of any organs at all, but consists entirely of shapeless, simple, homogeneous matter, nothing more than a shape, mobile, little lump of mucus or slime, yuck, consisting of albuminous combination of matter. And it's just a blob of protoplasm. And that's what Darwin thought. And obviously, if you just think that, then life can evolve. You know, it's just a simple thing, the cell. But nowadays, we have more than the microscopes that Darwin had at his time. And it's described that in order to see things so small, you can't use a regular microscope. Why is that? Because you're limited by the wavelength of light. I'm not going to get too technical. Because of the wavelength of light, you can only see things like half the wavelength of light, which means down to real small, but not inside a cell. So all you'll see in the cell with a normal microscope is just basically a blob. But recently, after about 1950, people came up with the electron microscope and the scanning electron microscope and enabled them to see inside the cell and see the complexity inside the cell. Just like in a Boeing 747, there's 5 million parts, and in a cell, there's billions of parts. And what I'm talking about is in each and every cell of your body, there's billions and billions of parts. They're called organelles. Billions, literally billions of parts. They're so complex. I mean, here's the basic diagram of some of those billions of parts. And, you know, there's the cilia, which means like the hair on the outside. It's not really hair, it's for something else. There's a lysosome, which is the garbage collection agency. Because when you have cellular garbage, you know, just like you have... Do you have people who pick up the garbage here? So you have to have a garbage department in the cell. And microtubules, I mean, that They're the tubules who are like the road system inside the cell. The Golgi apparatus, which forms the proteins. I'm just going through a few of those. The ribosomes that make the proteins, the nucleus, the cytoplasm, which is the goo inside the cell, the mitochondrion, which is the powerhouse of the cell. And it's much more complex than that. You got different types of cells. And this is all within our body and every living entity's body. This is what's happening inside you. There's trillions of these things inside you of different shape, doing different things simultaneously that enable you to live. And somehow or other, when you want something to happen, these cells cooperate with you. It's amazing. 100 trillion cells in the body. It's a lot. And according to the Vaishnava philosophy, each and every cell is a living entity. So you are the predominating deity of your body. Wow, you're the king. King of the hill. You know, so isn't that amazing? Somehow or other, you got the human form of life. Durlabham manasa janma tarap dhruva martidam, the Bhagavatam says, after it's very difficult to be a human being, even in within one's own body. What to speak of in life in general? In the microbes, there are so many microbes in the air. So I'm going to give you a little hint inside of what's going on inside the cell. We're going to look at one little machine inside the cell, which is called a kinesin. You don't have to remember it. It's not important what it does. Just to show you how complex the cell is and what is going on in the cell. This little video is called Molecular Machines. This is the workhouse of the cell, kinesin. Kinesin is a it's like the truck that carries everything within the cell. There's those nice little cilia that I talked about before. The hair in the cell, and then you got these connecting things that connect the different parts of the cell. Inside every cell in your body. If this isn't complex, I don't know what is. And these are different parts, the mitochondria, and then you're going to see my friend, this kinesin, who's basically like a nice athlete. So this kinesin you see here, he's the transport mechanism within the cell. He walks 1 foot in front of the other, you see? Carrying his load. It just happened by chance. There's no God. Pretty interesting, isn't it? And that's happening in every cell of your body. But of course, he walks a lot faster than is portrayed in this video. Super fast. He's a long-distance runner. And the interesting thing is if his load is actually too heavy for him, another of his buddies comes and helps him. And they know how to do it. And this whole microtubule is formed right in front of him. And he delivers whatever load it is, he is composed of a protein or proteins. Within the body, within the cell, these, let us say the machines are proteins. And these proteins, there's millions of different types of proteins. These proteins are made of what we call amino acids. And they have a chain of amino acids, and the chain of the amino acids to make them is decided by the DNA in the cell. So that's one example of a molecular machine. Very exciting. And we're going to talk about one particular type of molecular machine, which is the outboard motor on one-cell creatures, which is called a flageller. That's literally an outboard motor. And that particular machine, there's millions of machines in the cells, in the different cells in the body, but this is just one machine we're going to talk about and show how this machine could not have come about by chance. Here's another movie of a flagella. Some bacteria and some small creatures have many Here's the machine parts of it. It has exactly like a rotary engine in a vehicle. Some vehicles have rotary engines instead of the normal piston engines, particularly a type of car called the Mazda has a rotary engine. So this is exactly the same with 30 different parts. And these parts have been examined, 30 different independent parts, which are proteins in the cell. And they've been examined under the microscope. And this is one example from the human being. This is the sperm from a human being. And they have these little flagellates to go around with. Interesting. And there's a motor that spins at 100,000 revolutions per minute. What is that per second? Can anyone figure that out? 100,000 per minute? It's about 1,700 per second. That's a fast motor, isn't it? And it's not, it wasn't designed, it just happened by chance. Amazing. Okay, another one. I'm so much in love with the flagellum, I decided to show more pictures of it. I mean, somehow or other, it attracts me. Not as much as Krishna attracts me, but this is Krishna's creation. Here we go, 100,000 RPM. That means RPM means revolutions per minute. So when I see these things, I just admire Krishna more and more. How a great designer he is, you know, how intelligent he is. It just makes me more in love with Krishna. And so here's some of the flagellum creatures. Okay, it's enough flagellum consciousness for right now. So here's... Of course, this is what I do in my spare time. I just watch flagellum movies. So you see the parts of the motor here, the hook, which is like what we call a universal joint. There's a propeller there spinning 100,000 revolutions per minute. There's a bushing. Anyone knows about motors? There's a bushing. That means it doesn't move, but it's sort of like... it supports the moving thing. There's a C-ring, there's rotors, plasma membrane, and all of this is called the world's smallest rotary propulsion system. You can see how much in love I am with these because I keep showing more pictures of them. There's an intelligently designed rotary motor on the right and the bacterial flagellum. And one argument the evolutionists make against my particular argument is that, well, this flagellum, this animal with the flagellum, he just borrowed these particular, let's say, parts of the machine from another machine in another animal, or previously in the same species or whatever. But that's called the co-option argument. I'm giving you some of the atheist arguments. But actually, that argument doesn't hold because 20 of the parts of the flagellum are unique to the flagellum and have not occurred in any previous mechanism in any animal. Plus, when the evolutionists examine this, they see that the flagellum was earlier than any other mechanism. In other words, other mechanisms came from the flagellum. Don't worry, I won't bore you with more movies of the flagellum. Maybe I will. So here's let's say, not only is the flagellum, let's say, composed of all these intricate parts, but it had to be put together in a particular sequence. Like you see a house here is being put together first with the foundation, then the walls, then the ceiling, then the roof structure, and then the insulation on the roof. All those things have to happen in a particular sequence. So it's not just like you throw everything together and you get a flagellum, but it has to be put together. So that's another mechanism that puts together. Those are other proteins that assemble the flagellum. That's really interesting, isn't it? So it's unlimitedly complex. So the scientists have analyzed, this is called information theory, that if something... by chance would have the possibility of 1, I'm going to use a little scientific notation, 1 over 10 to the 50th power, it's the same as 10 to the negative 50th power, that thing is impossible to have occurred, basically for all intents and purposes. It's impossible to have occurred by chance. And you know, here's some other things, transportation inside the cell. So even Crick, who was the discoverer of the structure of the DNA molecule, he stated that it was impossible for this molecule to have come about by chance, what to speak of the flagellum, and he said it would have the same possibility of occurring by chance as if there was a tornado in a junkyard and a 747 came out of it. That's impossible. I mean, maybe you can say it's possible like 1 over 10 to the 1 billionth power or something like that. But basically, statistically, it is impossible. And this great philosopher, Henry Quastler, stated the creation of new information is habitually associated with conscious activity. So we examine this from the standpoint of having something that's improbable to have occurred by chance. This is a standard of information theory, that by chance it's very improbable, impossible, and not only it's impossible or improbable, but it has a recognizable pattern. There's many things that were improbable to have occurred by chance, but there's no recognizable pattern. They're just, it's all chaos. Like if I throw up a bunch of garbage in the air, it'll come down in a particular way, but it's chaotic. It has no pattern to it. But it's improbable that it would come down in that particular way, but there's no pattern, so it doesn't fit these two standards for understanding that something was designed. So let's look at certain things that are improbable and a recognizable pattern. What is this? Anybody know what that is? Where is it from? Easter Island. No. Christmas. Sometimes called Christmas Island. And you have these statues that are standing there. And if you say it happened by chance, you're pretty crazy. Because obviously somebody or a group of people made it. Here's another thing. What's this? A heart? What does it say? John. So you see this. Of course, you don't have too many beaches here unless you go to Croatia. And even in Croatia, you don't have too many sand beaches. So you can't really carve different things in the sand and the rock beaches you have in Croatia, right? But we have nice sand beaches where I come from. And so we carve different things, make different statues. And so you see that. Did it happen? Did the waves suddenly wash over and create John Loves Mary? This is a simple thing. This is not complex. But did it come about by chance? Is there any possibility that came about by chance? Somebody went there, somebody in love with Mary, or Mary was hoping something, that John would love her, and something happened, you know. Somebody did a conscious living entity. Here's another thing. That's also from ancient Egypt, and this, you know, it looks like random characters, but we can see that it has some pattern, and it didn't happen by chance. Here's another famous thing from the United States. This is called Mount Rushmore. And it has pictures of our presidents. And of course, I don't think they'll put our present president up there in the mountains. I hope not. No comment. So anyway, so, you know, someone can be approaching these mountains and say, well, it just happened by chance, the wind and the rain and everything like that. Cause it to happen? No way. Not possible. And this is simple. It's nothing like one cell. One cell is just infinitely more complex than these things that we see here. So here's the standard. When you look at something to determine if it happened by chance, you look at the information in it, the sophistication, the familiarity to patterns that you already see, the probability of it happening, the efficiency, the inexplicability. I mean, you look at all these different standards to determine if something has been designed. So, unfortunately, most atheistic scientists don't believe in this particular point. If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck, but they don't believe that. In this particular case, what they believe is the duck is a walrus. You know what a walrus is? Anyone know what a walrus is? No. Anyway, I guess I have to describe. How can you describe a walrus? A walrus is like a big monster creature with a big mustache and beard and everything.
The way they describe Satan.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks like Satan, basically. It's a creature that's from the North Pole. I think in the South Pole they have walruses, too. So, if you see a walrus there, you're crazy. So, in psychological language, this is called cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance means you see something, it's apparent it's happening, and you deny its existence. Isn't it? That's called a mental illness. So many scientists ascribe to methodological mental illnesses, not accepting it's obvious it's designed. And here's Srila Prabhupada. This is the final slide. Srila Prabhupada said about Darwin, what is his theory? We kick out Darwin's philosophy. The more we kick out Darwin's philosophy, the more we advance in spiritual consciousness. So I'm trying to advance in spiritual consciousness. Is one of the attempts I'm making to show, as Prabhupada presented to us, that life comes from life, and because life comes from life, there's ultimately a designer. I'll let you in on something really interesting, that Francis Crick, the discoverer of the shape of the DNA molecule, also admitted that this could not happen by chance, but he came up with a different theory. His theory was what we call panspermia, which means that they were directed panspermia. No one knows what that means? No. That means that there were living entities on other planets that implanted life on Earth. He didn't want to admit that there might be God, might be Krishna. So he said, well, just some aliens came and they planted life on Earth. Well, that's an interesting theory, but we also believe in that. Yeah, our theory, not theory, sorry, it's not a theory. The belief from the Vedic literatures, which we described in the beginning about the descending process of knowledge, is that, first of all, there's Krishna in the spiritual world. Okay, let's describe the whole thing going on in the spiritual world. Krishna is playing his flute, right? And he's just enjoying. So he expands himself in different ways, first of all, as in the Vaikuntha planets, and then later on as a portion of his plenary portion. This is a little technical for all of you. As Mahavishnu. Mahavishnu breathes out, the universes come out. That's the Big Bang, which we described before. And all the universes come out, which in each and every universe, Krishna expands himself another time, and he appears as another form called the Garbhodakshi Vishnu. And the Garbhodakshi Vishnu gives birth without Lakshmi to the first created being in this universe. What's his name? Anyone know? Brahma. And then Brahma assigns, using the intelligence that he got from Krishna through meditation, he assigns the duty of creating, not that four Kumaras didn't create. They did a different thing. Thank you for pointing that, because he has two different assignments he makes. One assignment he gives to people to preach, or to teach about spiritual things. That's the four Kumaras. Of course, the four Kumaras, originally he wanted them to create life, but they refused. You know, they're four young boys. Interesting story in the Bhagavatam. And Lord Brahma said, you should go and create different forms of life. There's a word for it, be Prajapatis. And they said, no, Dad. And he got angry, and, you know, a lot of things happened. Lord Shiva came out. Anyway, that's another issue. And then what happened is he assigned other people the duty of creating life. You have Kashyapa Muni, Kardama Muni, Daksha, our friend Daksha, who we're reading about in Srimad Bhagavatam class. So he assigned them the duties of creating all these different forms of life. And then he told the four Kumaras, along with Narada Muni and many of the sages, it's your business to teach people the purpose of this world. In philosophy, that's called teleology. First, this presentation was mainly about how do we know what we know, which is called epistemology. How do you know what you know? But then, more important than how do you know what you know is something called teleology. What's the purpose of everything? Because if you know the purpose of everything, you don't have to know all the other details. For example, if I know the purpose, let's say I have a car, and the purpose of a car is to go from one place to another, I don't need to know how it works. That's not so important. It's important to know what to use it for. So the purpose of this world is to rectify all of us who are here because we decided to come here, and to give us the chance to actually reconnect with the original creator, which is Krishna. The original creator, not the subsequent creator, which is Krishna. And so therefore, Lord Brahma sends a lot of people out to share Krishna consciousness. And he creates his own line of disciplic succession, which is called the Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya, which we are members of. So, anyway, everything has a purpose. Life has a purpose. Not only was life created like this by intelligence, but there's also a purpose to the life. So, thank you very much. So, any questions or comments? Yes?
Why doesn't ISKCON challenge the ritual doctrines of the public?
We do.
Really?
Yeah. Actually, we have established, not we, but ISKCON has the Bhaktivedanta Institute that's specifically been formulated for that purpose. One of my godbrothers who passed away, Richard Thompson, Sataputta, he was quite expert and published several books about information theory and what I'm talking about right now.
Yeah, but not in books, like in Life Challenge. Like we see Richard Dawkins, he has on YouTube like these debates with leaders of Abrahamical religions,
yeah.
But you don't see any sannyasis or anyone from this.
Well, I'm open to it.
Yes, you should do it.
Okay. Okay, why don't you contact Richard Dawkins to see if he's willing to speak?
You contacted. You have
okay,
a,
I will.
You have a name.
You can be my press secretary.
No. I'm just a hippie. You have all the prestige, the knowledge.
You're a hippie and I'm a happy.
Yeah.
That's what Prabhupada said his miracle that he was changing hippies into happies.
Yeah.
So you want to be a happy?
I am happy, but you can change the scientists into religious people.
Okay, we're working on it.
Work faster.
Yes. Yes, sir. Yeah, your question.
I have a question. In 2001 was locked out in London.
Yeah.
So there is one question was coming when we have been reading. You know, it says you must read some books. Then I was reading one book. It said, if human being exists, God doesn't exist. And if God exists, human being doesn't exist.
Why?
And
what's their logic?
The end of the logic say that, this Aristotle said that, said the end say that, if a human being exists and God exists, one must be a slave of another one.
That's right. I don't mind being... because our natural constitutional position, according to the Bhagavad Gita, is Mami Vangsa Jivaloke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana Manashashtani Andriyani Prakriti Stani Karshati. We're part and parcel of God. Just like, all right, here's my hand, right? Of course, not my hand, it's part of the body, which I'm not, but you got it. So, if my hand exists and I exist, then the hand must be my slave, right? because if the hand, this is a typical example Prabhupada always gives. If the hand tries to enjoy life separately from me, you know, I got problems. I have to see a doctor. You know, the hand keeps going like that, you know. Yeah. Calm down, you know. So the hand's natural condition is to serve the body. But then the hand's happy. I'm not torturing the hand to serve me. It likes it. If the hand wants to be separate, it's not going anywhere. You know, just cut off the hand, you know, it's useless. So the hand can enjoy by serving. So our constitutional position, according to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is Jivera Swarupohai Nicha Krishna Das. And that makes us happy. I mean, I'm happy. I'm serving Krishna so many years and it gets better all the time. So, anyway, so that's that logic. Okay, any other questions? Because we've gone on a little bit longer than... Yeah, I can't see back there. What's that?
You agree that DNA programming is very dangerous, even for extinction of human life?
Reprogramming. Oh, reprogramming the DNA, yeah. The scientists have this thing called CRISPR. You've heard of this before? No. CRISPR is a device where they reprogram the DNA. And they don't, you know, of course, I think you're all familiar with GMO stuff. I think everyone's heard of that. That's how they do it. They take, GMO means genetically modified organisms. Frankenstein. Anyone's heard of Frankenstein here? Frankenstein was the doctor who created the monster. So it's very dangerous when they do that. And there's so many diseases that if people eat GMO food, there's so many diseases that could occur that they're not aware of, you know, 10 years from now or 5 years from now. And therefore, in many countries, they've forbidden GMO food. And if people are trying to design human beings, which they want to do eventually in the future, that's very dangerous. Because it's been designed very specifically, the DNA, and if you mess with it, you don't know what you're going to get from it.
It's like a checksum or a blueprint that is a picture, and if you change the eye color of a child, it can lead to huge disease.
Yeah, you don't know what the repercussions will be. You're absolutely true. Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for that comment. So therefore, we really shouldn't mess with life, with manipulating the genes. I have a whole other presentation, which I'm not going to do today. I'm sure you're relieved by that, about the genes and the DNA and the RNA and all that other nice stuff, and showing how there is information contained in the genes that is obviously been programmed by a programmer. Obviously. Because it's more complex than what we talked about today. Much more complex. And the possibility of even one protein coming about by chance, I'll give you a coming attraction, is 1 over 10 to the 87th power. What that means, 87th power means 10 with 87 zeros. I don't even know what that number is called. Does anyone know? It's big. That means one. The possibility of it happening is so small that there's less particles in the whole universe. Less particles in the whole universe than the possibility of that happening. You know, in other words, hasn't happened. It can't happen. That's one protein, and this particular device we showed you, the flagellum, is composed of 30 different proteins. So to figure out the possibility, okay? And if anyone's interested, you can communicate with me and talk to me later because I've studied information theory and the mathematics of this whole thing. All right, I think it's time for prasadam, right? Oh, kirtan. Oh, and after kirtan, you got to feed all those cells in your body. They're all hungry. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai.